LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
Joe Biden got his hand caught in the classified cookie jar, and there's action at the Supreme Court on guns and unions, and more, all right now on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising, with Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
We're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza, and joining me today from Studio C?
Studios have all been rearranged since the pandemic.
You pick a letter. No. Mr. Timothy Elting Donner, LibertyNation.com's senior political analyst.
In a redesignated studio, is that okay? What we're going to call it?
It's the mystery studio then. All right, we've got...
We'll call it Southern Command.
Chock-a-block full of stories for this week, including the woke soccer coach, the Biden docs, and a whole bunch of gun stories and some stuff from the Supreme Court. And a big announcement from one of the most important Democrats in the country to cap off the show, Tim. Let's jump right into the...
I get a sense you're being just a touch sarcastic with that.
Well, you'll have to see at the end of the show.
I'll have to wait like everybody else.
Okay. Let's talk about these classified documents first. And I think why beat around the bush? Let's just go right to the conscience of our nation, Tim.
No, man, what you just said is right, that there are differences in what happened.
Yes, but you know, the not good.
Well, we all know that Trump is a liar and a thief. You know, so it's not that big a jump to say that he obstructed and he lied. We don't think that Biden is a liar and a thief, so we give him the benefit of the doubt. That's partly what's going on. But what I think also is going on, no matter what the truth of it is, Whoopi, they will spin it. Bobblehead and Marjorie Taylor and that crowd, Matt Gaetz, you think they're not going to spin this, that it's just as bad as Trump? And so the lie gets out there. People believe it, just like that Donaldson person, whatever his name is.
Byron.
What's his name?
Byron
Donalds. I saw him also. He was at the fight on the floor, too, wasn't he?
He was nominated for speaker.
Right, he's an Uncle Tom, right.
He's the new darling.
15 rounds.
Darling of the Republican
the
Party.
The lying has been so invasive, so ubiquitous, that no one will believe the truth anymore. And that you can put that at the feet of Donald Trump, who started the lying.
So
it's Donald Trump's fault, Tim, that Joe Biden went and had classified documents he wasn't supposed to have. Now, by the way, the latest reporting, and we're at just shy of 10 a.m. on the 12th, that there's a second tranche of documents from some other location.
Yep.
But the classified documents.
The thing that's important about the second tranche, and by the way, nice use of that word. I appreciate it. Your faux French. The tranche of... sort of like when you used to dine at Le Bec Fin in Philadelphia.
I'd reference
one of the
sadly,
premier restaurants in the city of brotherly
love. Once upon a time.
No, the thing about the second tranche is Mark Angelides pointed this out in his article on LibertyNation.com that, you know, the protestation of the administration that, you know, this was just kind of a mistake, the first group, the first tranche that was found, just kind of a mistake. But the fact that there's a second means it's not a mistake. I mean, that's a pretty fundamental difference. I mean, I think everybody, let's put it this way, if this was Trump, it'd be headlines all over the country. Instead, the compliant establishment media is trying to minimize it and say, well, in no way is it like Donald Trump. And again, they're not saying it quite as blatantly as Joy Behar. But the truth is the same. They think the same thing, that look, Trump's a liar and a thief, so he's guilty by virtue of our opinion of his personality, whereas Joe Biden's a wonderful, honest guy, so it must have been a simple mistake.
Legally speaking, there is a vast difference between the two instances, the Trump documents and the Biden documents. And the difference
One's from a Democrat, the other's from a Republican. That's biggest difference.
The biggest difference, Tim, is that without question, the president of the United States has the legal authority to declassify documents. But it's debatable about whether or not the vice president of the United States has the legal authority to declassify certain documents.
Is it even debatable?
So hold on. So legally speaking, Donald J. Trump is in a much superior position claiming that he did no legal wrongdoing than Joe Biden does. And here's why. The president of the United States, the right way to think about it is like they're his person, like they belong to him almost while he's in office. I'm talking about not while somebody who's left office, but while the president of the United States, what he says about a document, whether it's classified or not, goes, that's not reviewable by any kind of court.
He's the ultimate authority.
Absolutely. It's a constitutional authority that he holds, right?
He's the singular executive.
Yeah. And whether or not the vice president has that authority, I mean, basically the vice president kind of has the authority to do what the president says almost. And in the executive orders that govern these classified documents, the vice president has the power under the written orders. Basically, he can declassify any document that he classified or that his office classified. Whether he can declassify other documents is up for debate. You know, we don't have, there's a reason why this is not like laid out in some phone book thick size ruling about vice presidential declassification, because it's not important. In other words, the president would just, if the vice president declassified something that the president wanted to keep classified, he would just reverse the order and implement his own policy. So it's a bit of a nothing burger in either case. But if people want to argue about it, and the reason why I think it's important to bring it up, because if you want to argue about it, you have to say that the president's authority is superior, Tim.
Well, certainly, I think the issue with Trump was more whether he had physically actually exercised his power to declassify, which is, again, that's subject to interpretation. In other words, he has the right to classify because he's the president of the United States. But if he doesn't actually exercise that authority in any official way, then his stuff that he takes that's classified is he entitled
to? Here's why that argument, I think, falls apart. And I wrote about this for the sponsor of today's podcast, LibertyNation.com, your source for conservatarian news and analysis 24/7, Tim. And I referenced the, which I think is a fun term, that I saw, it's like everywhere on Twitter, that Trump telepathically declassified the documents. Right. And the reason why that's sort of a thing out there is because in some of these executive orders, there's a sort of pathway where, documents are to be declassified, then there's like some process by which they're, you know, it's announced to like a group of people who it's important to know, that they're declassified. But that's not a law, and that's not part of the Constitution. The president's power comes from it comes from the United States Constitution. Unless you amend the Constitution to say the president has to do X, Y, and Z to declassify, then yes, he actually can, quote unquote, telepathically do it, because the second he decides to, in other words, if I have this, so I have a piece of paper in my hand, my formerly nicotine stained fingertips, Tim. And if I, if this were a class, if I were president of the United States and this was a classified document on my desk and I had, let's say, a reporter sitting across the table from me, and I wanted to declassify and disclose that to the reporter, I could just hand the document to them and in my mind think, I'm now declassifying this document. I don't have to file a memo. I don't have to submit some form to publish in the Code of Federal Regulations. Uh-huh. This is now declassified. Just by doing it and thinking it, I did declassify it. So, you know, from the jump, I think I've never once thought that Donald Trump was in any kind of, you know, criminal jeopardy for what he had. Now, the only way that would change is if he actually didn't think that or do it through thought while he was president. So that would be the only hang up. And of course, the only way that you could get that information would be if Trump himself said, oh, no, I didn't mean to do that while, you know.
Right. Right.
So I think the case against Trump was a nothing burger. And I think it's a nothing burger against Biden, too, except politically.
Right.
And I think that politically it is a massive, massive loser for the man. And,
I think it is, too.
So how is this going to hit politically?
Well, what it does is it neuters one essential line of attack on Trump, which is that, you know, the raid on Mar-a-Lago, all of that takes a different context. You're going to hear the left stopping any talk about classified documents. And I think it also devalues the probably by reflection, probably devalues the investigation of Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, and others, and makes it look again like a double standard if they're going to continue to lambaste Trump for these things. What it does on the January 6th matter, I don't know, but it's not going to help the Democrats' cause. It, you know, again, if it had been reversed and Biden had been snagged first, I think then that the whole situation would be entirely different, because then if Trump did it second, they couldn't really say anything. But because he did it first, they could make a big deal out of it, make a big splash, send the FBI in, and make, you know, a huge deal out of it. But of course, the media is the pivot point on all of this stuff, because, I mean, for example, Exhibit A, if the Hunter Biden story had been about Trump's kid, I mean, he would have probably been impeached and perhaps convicted, right? But for Biden, it's something that can be buried because of big box media. So,
and they look, you know, at that, again, it's unverifiable. It's just, those claims, they're not capable of being verified.
Which ones?
Those laptop claims. Come on, they've looked at this. This is water under the bridge at this point.
Well, they actually, I think the left should be given a great deal of credit, because they were willing to spend 18 months from the discovery of the laptop until they after exhaustive investigation, well after the 2020 election, of course, they admitted that everything on there was real, right? So you know, now the whole line of attack from Democrats with the help of the media is the Democratic reaction to the politically motivated attacks by mean Republicans.
Well, speaking of
on this president.
Speaking of political, it's just so funny. I was going to say something that just to try to be some dry humor, but I couldn't do it because it's just I can't hold my laughter. And the notion that Joe Biden has something to worry about from an investigation from the Biden Garland Department of Justice on this matter. Right. You know, there's no independent counsel. It's just farmed out to a U.S. attorney. I will note that U.S. attorney is a Trump appointee holdover. So that's not nothing. But still, it's a DOJ lawyer. What are they going to do? They're going to Garland's going to recommend prosecution of I mean, it's it. It's quite preposterous. And it's why the independent counsel statute was passed. Now, for this, I don't think, you know, except for the political part of it, which I get, the idea that we would spend a nickel's worth of taxpayer money on investigating the current president of the United States' possession and housing of, you know, classified documents somewhere else, you know, say what you will about Joe Biden, just like Donald Trump, it's preposterous that he gave the documents to the Russians. Like Joe Biden, I don't know what he was doing with these documents, but I don't want my money, my tax dollars going to investigate this stuff. It's ridiculous.
It's all political now.
Yeah.
It's all politically motivated. I don't think anybody believes that any of the documents Trump has have fallen into the wrong hands or were offered up for money to our enemies. I mean, come on. Even the left, they want to throw that out there as some sort of possibility. They know damn well that's not true. So
I'll tell you, yeah, it's a
non-issue.
Hardest hit with this story, I think, is the think tank, the Penn Biden think tank, which having such great products come out of it.
The University of Pennsylvania might as well be. Let's just summarize the whole story by saying,
Watch your step. Okay. The
University of Pennsylvania
here
might just as well be called the University of Biden because of the Biden Center.
I didn't have enough time to look it up.
And the great intellectual heft ordered up by Joe Biden.
He directed so much federal dollars towards them that the payoff was this Biden Center. So he and his toadies could basically get a place to have like health insurance while they were waiting for him to get the presidency, you know, that the gap during the Trump
years. I think he did show up once and give like a 25-minute speech.
Oh, at Tim, Penn. Sadly, it was not 25 minutes, I'm sure.
Was it Castro?
Probably. I mean, I just made that up, but
it was like several hours.
I'm guessing that it was.
Yeah. We'll to offer, Scott. It can't be encapsulated in a mere 25 minutes. I mean, we're talking about a truly great man here.
We will continue to follow it, of course. And let's go ahead and talk about this. Charles Chugger Adair, who is an accomplished former professional soccer player and soccer coach for Virginia Tech. Tim, you and I, sadly, both are required to pay some measure of taxes to the Commonwealth of Virginia, and we will be paying part of the $100,000 settlement that Kirsten Henning got from Virginia Tech because Coach Adair bullied and verbally assaulted and then benched Ms. Henning because she didn't want to kneel during the reading of like the unity statement for the BLM craze after Mr. Floyd died. And it's just a disgusting story of this coach, this woke coach who wouldn't let this girl just not agree, you know, and it's a state school and they have to.
Well, she wouldn't kneel.
Yeah,
right. She refused
to take the knee, Tim, to the woke ideology, and she sued, and they lost a motion hearing in December, which basically meant that it was going to go to trial. And what Coach Adair and you, I keep wanting to say UVA, and it's not UVA, it's Virginia Tech. And Virginia Tech argued is that even if he did violate her constitutional rights by benching her. And by the way, she was, you know, you look at her record, a walk-on player to a D1 program I can't say
very unusual.
It's so impressive, you know.
No, I don't know much about soccer, especially college soccer or pro
especially
soccer.
Especially college women's soccer.
Or Manchester United soccer or any of that. But it is in almost any Division I sport, and certainly I know about basketball and football, for example, Division I, a walk-on is maybe somebody that sits at the end of the bench, never plays. But they never rarely become significant contributors.
And she was a starter her freshman and sophomore years. This was her junior
as year. A walk-on. That's
yeah,
rare.
Yeah. And this is her junior year. And as soon as she refuses to take the knee, he benches her. And so she lost out on, you know, what could have been great seasons for her junior and senior year.
Well, I sure am glad she got the award and that somebody somewhere has made the pay for the summer from hell of 2020.
We're the ones who are made to pay is my point. It's, you know.
You're right.
They're not firing Coach Adair.
Well, let's put it this way.
They're firing the Virginia Tech leadership.
I'll tell you what, I'm willing to pay my portion as a Virginia taxpayer. Because the judgment is the thing that's important here.
Yeah.
The judgment that this woman was wronged.
You know,
and that's the important thing, because I personally think, Scott, of all the systemic problems that we've got in this country, the biggest single one is the absolute abridgment of free speech on college campuses.
Oh, yeah.
Because these are the people that are being trained as future leaders, and they're not hearing all the sides of an argument. They're hearing one side. God, Scott, I remember when I went to college, there were the craziest ideologies that were getting up there and making, you know, sit on their soapbox in the quadrangle, neo-Nazis, every other kind of, you know, fringe group you could think of, every kind of conspiracy theorist, left and right and center, whatever. That's part and parcel of the college experience, to hear all the points of view, to hear every angle and decide for yourself. And the fact that that's really no longer even possible. I mean, it really isn't.
When liberals controlled it, it was possible. When the progressives took over, the first thing they did was crush under their jackboot the notion of free speech. I think
you're absolutely right.
David Horowitz talked a lot about this with his book. I can't remember the name of it, though, but he talked about his own college experience. And, you know, the students then were these super radicals. And the difference was that the professors didn't discriminate against them because of their ideology. You know, they allowed them to speak.
Nor did
they would
favor them. They either favored.
Which, by the way, I just want to make this one point before we close out the soccer story there on Coach. Well, there's two points. One of them, the social media angle is kind of interesting. They posted this, he and the school posted this panel with all these past players. And it's so funny because they say that those players thought there's no basis for the charges against Coach Adair. But none of those players were on the team when he benched Ms. Henning, and also they didn't read the complaint. Like, the evidence is in the complaint, you know.
Does he get to keep his job?
Absolutely. Oh, big thank you to the administration for supporting him in the wake of the settlement. He also wrote that there was like a lack of standing, and he just made it up. It's just like he just pulled out of thin air. Like, he said, oh, there was no evidence that presented. It's like, well, that's what the trial's for. And this is the thing I wanted to say, which was, I think this is actually what motivated the settlement. Now, it's total speculation, but what happens is, because they lost this motion to dismiss in December, and they were going to have to go to trial, I think it might have been February or March that the trial date was scheduled. Tim, the discovery that would have been allowed, the pretrial discovery, would have been all the messages, text messages, emails, and so forth between him and other members of the administration. I think what that would have revealed would have been a really dirty, disgusting coordination against this woman's free speech rights. And so I think that's probably what motivated the settlement more than anything else.
You know, the absolute cowardice of these, you know, purveyors of wokeness is just breathtaking. I mean, it's, you know, it's like they were probably liberal and somewhat progressive And then the George Floyd thing happens. And now all of a sudden they snap into a radical progressivism and completely abridge people's free speech. I mean, it's almost like, Scott, I remember a movie. I think it was called Not Without My Daughter. It's with Sally Fields.
And I know it. I've seen it.
She's visiting Iran and her husband
married an Iranian guy and moved there, right?
Right. And they were happy living in the U.S. And then they visit Iran and they see her.
And the revolution
happens. Relatives are having a fine time. And then the revolution. Yeah. And then Khomeini comes into power. And all of a sudden, everybody who was friendly and pro-Western is now radically Islamic. Yeah. And it's almost like that happened with the George Floyd incident. Suddenly, everybody, all the cowardly people that are in these universities and institutions and in Congress just suddenly became radicalized because, well, that's what everybody else was doing and I better get on board. I mean, it just, that summer and what happened in it, Scott, was the most sickening political turn of events I've seen in my lifetime.
Yeah. All right, let's move along. We've got this FAA shutdown. The only thing I want to say about it is I haven't heard anybody talk about this. So I'll just ask you, does this measurably impact Pete Buttigieg's chances to be the next president of the United States? And also, has anybody looked at the videotape to see if Kamala Harris has been fleeing the scene with a pair of wire cutters in order to help queer his chances? No pun intended.
Well, let me see if I can unpack all of that, Scott. It's a hefty load. I think the thing that people are centered on here is if this is a massive cyber attack, and I guess there's no evidence of it, but I don't know about you. Have you ever seen this kind of FAA shutdown before? I don't think I have. No. So, I don't know who gets blamed for this other than, I guess, Southwest Airlines is probably the happiest because it takes the headlines away from them.
You know what? I hadn't thought of that, Tim.
Yeah. Southwest is the
that would actually
beneficiary.
That's another level of like crisis counseling, if you can get that done. In other words, like, listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to shut down air travel throughout the whole country. And then nobody will. That's some evil genius stuff right there if that was what happened.
Well, I think they need to look into the board of directors of Southwest Airlines and see if there was any nefarious activity to take the spotlight off of them.
Well, while we're talking about politics, I'll just ask you, this Joe Isuzu, of Congressman George Santos, who just seems now like he really is. He bought that. Was it Hitler's line about like, if you lie big enough, he just lies about everything. Like there's almost nothing the guy hasn't just fabricated, it seems like.
He has presented a fantastical life. In other words, it's a total fantasy. This is the life that you basically create if you are allowed to run for office. If someone says to you, okay, you get to create your own reality and run for office on it, that's what he did.
Do you think stops along the way was like, I can't believe they're buying this. Nobody's going to check any of this.
It's sort of like the old Dukakis, John Lovitz playing Dukakis in the debate with Bush 41. I can't believe I'm losing to this guy. Santos, I mean, to me, it's a caricature of the whole political system in the way people lie and make stuff up. I mean, for example, the sitting senator in Connecticut lied about fighting in Vietnam. I mean, he said he was in combat in Vietnam and he wasn't. And yet he's been elected, three times?
Well, I was going to say, at least for that case, the voters don't seem to care. So they've weighed in on it. And, oh, boy.
And I find it disturbing. that the voters don't seem to care about that because
he's literally oily, like the oily politician. Just you take a look at him. He's so.
If you're going to lie about that, what will you not lie about? I mean, look at Joe Biden's made his whole career on. Well, we're not going to say I'm not going to characterize the lies as necessarily disqualifying in the political system.
No, he's like Walter Mitty with his stuff.
Where he finished, you know, in his class at Syracuse Law School.
No joke.
A ton of stuff he made at the stories that he made up. And then the media defends him to say, well, he's trying to make a point. He's just doing it for effect to make an important point about this or that, you know.
Well, the funny thing is, and it's appropriate to slam Mr. Santos for his ridiculous lies and really kind of fraud on the people, I think, in some way. But the funny thing is, the idea that you could punish a politician for lying, none of the politicians want that to actually be a part of the lie constantly.
I do not see any hue and cry on Capitol Hill to run this guy out of office.
As P.J. O'Rourke said, it's a parliament of whores.
I suppose the best you could say is that is the art of politics, but I think it's honestly, I don't like to, you know, sort of approve of that level of dishonesty, but you got to admit, it's pretty funny that he was able to pull it off and nobody bothered to check his stories in an age. I mean, this is the internet, Scott. People can tweet anything, anytime, anywhere, and it goes global. And this guy's running for Congress, and nobody could discover that not one, but basically every one of his narratives was false. Nobody figured that out. That's pretty amusing to me.
If you can't, you have to laugh because otherwise you'd have to cry. So
that's pretty much. Right. Yeah, it's just about that.
All right, let's turn our attention to the work of our United States Supreme Court, which had a couple of noteworthy cases this week. One of there was a union case that's getting a lot of press. It's called Glacier Northwest versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And it had oral arguments this week. And there's a lot of ink being spilled, like it could be the end of unions and that kind of thing. And I just thought I'd bring it up. It's an interesting case. These Teamsters for a unionized cement business wanted to screw the employers and in the process of going on strike. So they knew they were going to go on strike. And what happened was they called the strike at a time in the morning when the cement trucks would be laden with product and would not be able to deliver the product or to their customers or return it to the plant in a method and manner that would actually preserve it. So they tried to screw them by basically, not only are they, we're going to go on strike, but we're going to make you lose, you know, all the many thousands of dollars worth of cement because of how we're going to time it. And so they sued, the cement plant sued the union itself and said, you basically have committed a tort against us, a legal wrong by, timing it this way. You're allowed to go on strike. They weren't disputing that. But what they're saying is you're not allowed to purposefully, you know, destroy our product or time your strike with a purpose of destroying our product. And so that was the case at the court. And I don't have a sense of how they're going to rule on it, but I think it's somewhat interesting.
Do they have, is there a some mainstream thought that if the union loses this, it's going to weaken them more?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the
broadly. I mean,
the pro-union people out there are raising an alarm, like a panic, like this could, you know, this could be the end of unions. Now, I would prefer that because I think that it's generally violative of the right to contract. In other words, I think that the law as it stands allows for the imposition of unions. And I just think that's an impermissible infringement on people's right to contract. If I start a cement plant, for instance, and I only want to contract with people individually for their labor, and I don't wish to bargain with them collectively, I think that it, as a free person with a free right of contract, that seems to be part of the bundle of rights I hold as a free person. I would actually prefer that to be the case. But to your question, I don't think it's likely. I don't think the court's likely to fashion some remedy that does, in fact, lead to the end of unions.
Well, you're free to run your business as you see fit. Now, of course, some of that cement that was delivered could be put in the form of shoes.
And there you go.
Suddenly you disappear.
Spoken like a New Yorker.
I was trying to sound Philadelphian.
Now the New Yorkers, they lead in cement shoe production. They lead. They're no second place.
Has there been a survey of that?
Well, this is my survey.
Well, based on what can you make that assertion?
I'm an Italian from the area.
You got sources. Yeah.
All right.
Hey, last time I stayed in New York, I was near Columbus Circle. You want to know that?
Congratulations, Tim. Yeah. The other thing that the Supreme Court did this week was they let.
You're welcome.
There's this impetus in the country. A lot of states are seemingly ignoring the Supreme Court's ruling in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin, which asserted this, massive leap forward in the protection of Americans' gun rights. And there was basically the Supreme Court shut down the New York State law that basically said that almost no one can own a gun. And if you were lucky enough to own one, you pretty much couldn't do anything with it. That's my nutshell analysis of what the law said.
You meant to say if you're connected enough to qualify.
Well,
for one.
Of course. Yeah, obviously. Yes, if you're a friend of, friend of the Cuomos, you get to do whatever you like. So then they passed this law that said, okay, we're going to allow carry of firearms, but we're going to prohibit it in lots of places, and including any retail store that doesn't have a sign that welcomes you with a gun, and just these preposterous measures that seem to fly in the face of both the Constitution and the fresh decision that they were responding to. So gun owners went to court. The district court judge granted an injunction against the new law's enforcement, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the injunction. And the case is then proceeding on the normal track. So these injunctions are, for sort of immediate addressing of the issue. But then the underlying challenge is actually proceeding under the sort of normal case flow. Well, the gun owners went to the Supreme Court for the emergency docket and said, we need you to overturn the Second Circuit's overturning of the injunction. We need that injunction in place because the current law violates your ruling in the Bruin case. And the Supreme Court declined the opportunity to do that. They said, no, we're not going to overturn the Second Circuit's ruling. And that's been sort of given play like it was a blow towards Second Amendment or gun owners. But I don't think it is. I don't think that's the right way to view it, Tim. And the reason why is because this is an emergency docket case, and when the Supreme Court declines to act on the emergency docket, it's rarely wise to then kind of use that as, well, this is how the court feels about this issue, because it wasn't a briefed case and it wasn't heard. And I think it was Alito and Thomas actually made a note with the order that declined to overturn the Second Circuit. And they said, this is about respecting the Second Circuit's process. They haven't, they have to address this case before we will. And we expect they'll do it in short order. And if they decline to do it in short order, we expect that the litigants can come back to us and try again if they're not moving fast enough. But right now, the time hasn't elapsed yet for us to think that this is warranted to kind of overstep, and kind of reach our hand down and take the case out of their court. So that's where that stands. But these legislatures in these really, really blue states have just gone wild with disrespecting the Supreme Court. I will be writing about this in a forthcoming piece for LibertyNation.com, the sponsor of today's program.
Well, and it's not just on guns, of course, it's on abortion, so that the left is reacting, what you would say, in a politically violent way to their law.
By the way, politically violent, that sounds like something a progressive would say about free speech. It's politically violent.
Right, that's right, right. But, you know, there's this extreme reaction to guns, and especially now to abortion, that has actually caused, I mean, it's kind of ironic, and I don't have a quantity on this or a count of how many states, but there are states that are increasing a woman's rights when it comes to abortion, making it more available. And the private industry, of course.
Well,
states like New York are trying to get tourists. I guess what you call tourist abortions, people that come in from red states.
This makes your skin crawl to even hear it. But I want to draw a distinction here, Tim, because with the abortion issue, the Supreme Court did send it to the states and said, you figure it out, right? This Roe wasn't a part of the Constitution.
Right, but that's not how they took it. They didn't take it as it's now.
No, I get it.
No woman will ever be allowed to have an abortion again.
But the guns thing is different because they did the opposite with guns. This is a national ruling. Right. And what we're seeing from the states is them just almost ignoring what the Supreme Court does. And in some cases, it seems like they're almost just giving the court the finger. Let's go ahead and listen to Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who signed an AR-15 ban just this week, which seems to, again, fly directly in the face of the court's rulings.
And more breaking news tonight, Governor J.B. Pritzker signing an assault weapons ban in Illinois just about 30 minutes ago. The governor was joined by gun control activists and legislators as he signed the bill at the Capitol.
Typically, Governor Pritzker takes his time signing comprehensive pieces of legislation. It can be weeks or months before there's a signing ceremony, but not this time. This was different.
With the stroke of his pen, Governor J.B. Pritzker made Illinois the 9th state to ban assault-style weapons.
Today, I couldn't be prouder to say that we got it done. We got this done for all the victims, the spouses, the children, parents, friends, and loved ones who are no longer with us, and for those who have survived mass shootings.
Passing gun legislation is never easy. After a private battle that lasted for days, Democrats who control the legislature move forward. Monday night, the Senate tweaked the House bill, and today the House concurred. The legislation bans the manufacture, sale, and delivery of assault-style weapons. Owners of such guns can keep them, but they must register them with the state by January 1st. Failure to do so is a misdemeanor and then a possible felony for subsequent offenses. Also, the sale of large-capacity ammunition magazines, more than 10 rounds for long guns, 15 rounds for handguns, are banned.
Locally, sheriffs from Ogle, Lee, Stevenson, and Winnebago counties say they won't comply with the law, calling it unconstitutional.
It's not the intent of law enforcement to make the law-abiding citizens criminals. They have a right to defend themselves. They have a right to possess and own firearms, and that's upheld in the Constitution. And as your constitutional sheriff, that's something that we have planned to continue with.
Last night, Governor Pritzker addressed those who would choose not to enforce the law.
The fact is that, yes, there are, of course, people who are trying to politically grandstand, who want to make a name for themselves by claiming that they will not comply. But the reality is that the state police is responsible for enforcement, as are all law enforcement all across the state. And they will, in fact, do their job, or they won't be in their job.
Now, Tim, I'm going to suggest to you, and I think, you know, I respect your religious beliefs, but that he wasn't struck down by a bolt of lightning at that moment argues that there is no God above us, Tim. But then he says that grandstanding, he calls the sheriffs who are saying they'll refuse to enforce this unconstitutional law, that they're the ones that are grandstanding. boy, what a chestnut from the governor.
Well, it's one of the great canards of our time, which is that rounding up more guns from law-abiding citizens will make the country safer, when in fact that's not. Let me use this to say that that's not just false. It's the opposite of the truth. The opposite of the truth. The truth is...
Yeah, that's the right way to say it.
An armed citizenry makes us all safer because criminals are criminals because they don't obey the law. And the fact that we pass more gun laws isn't going to turn them into law-abiding citizens. End of story.
And the carnage, by the way, on the streets of Chicago, which is perhaps the worst in the country, is not done. They don't use AR-15s. It's just they're unwieldy. They're too long to conceal them on one's person as you walk down the streets of Chicago, or even having a car. It's a bit of a hassle. So the idea that this is somehow going to do anything, I mean, even if I almost hate that I even made that argument, because it doesn't matter if it would, because the Constitution requires that we respect Americans' rights to keep and bear arms, and to use the whole, they could have actually done something to legislate in some manner that may have elevated the lives of Illinoisans. I don't know what that would be. The best thing would probably be if they just went home and left people alone. But in any case, to use their money and resources to pass a law that, by the way, it's going to go through the courts, it's going to get stricken down. You heard it here. This will not withstand a review in the federal courts.
But then people like Governor Pritzker can say this is evidence of the systemic rot, at the Supreme Court, and it's their fault. And so he gets another opportunity for demagoguery out of it, at least, even if the law that he passed won't ultimately hold up, which he knows perfectly well it won't. That's maybe the worst part of its gut, is they pass these things, just like the McCain-Feingold bill that shut down free speech 30 days before an election. They knew damn well that was unconstitutional. They went ahead and passed it anyway and said, okay, well, the Supreme Court will take care of it if it's a problem. That's no way to govern. And Pritzker knows perfectly well that what he's doing won't pass constitutional muster, but he doesn't care, nor does the predominant media care to take him on about it. They just write the sanitized story that the streets are safer because AR-15s are not in the hands of law-abiding citizens.
Well, actually doing something to reduce violence is probably impossible or really hard, but getting, wearing that orange ribbon and clapping for yourself is a lot easier to make it happen. All right, let's go to the news, I think, that really shook the nation this week politically. We have a major announcement. Let's just go to the tape, Tim. Here we go. Now, I forgot, Tim, we have to specify that not everybody gets a chance to watch our beautiful visages as they consume the Uprising podcast and they listen to it. And we're watching a clip from the Drew Barrymore show with special guest Ms. Stacey Abrams announcing her, here it is.
So what's next? Are you going to run again? Are you going? Do we get to look forward to this and galvanize again?
I will likely run again. I don't know.
Oh, my God. So are you going to go up against some tough men who kind of don't always play fair?
Well, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And if it doesn't work, you try again.
Now,
and again, and again, and again, and again.
I love that it's an anti.
She's the black Beto O'Rourke.
Is anybody on earth actually that excited that Stacey Abrams may may run again for office. And how funny is it that she's a victim, Tim. She's a victim of evil men. It's just, to me, it's just the...
I think six words...
I'm sitting on the case for the wokeism.
Six words would describe Stacey Abrams circa 2023. The bloom is off the rose.
How many times are you going to... It's like Mitt Romney. How many times are you going to run for an office?
Well, she thought, because she did come very, very close to winning in 2018, but she got her butt kicked this time. She lost by like 8 points. And she couldn't claim, you know, an 8-point loss. You can't really claim voter fraud or, you know, the suppression of the black vote or anything like that. Especially when her black colleague, Raphael Warnock, defeated Herschel Walker.
He won by three points, she lost by eight.
So there's an 11-point gap between Raphael Warnock and
more evidence of the patriarchy.
Yes, that's true. You can't, in this case, better to blame men than white people. I mean, it depends on the situation. Just white people in general is one thing that she could complain about. It's a cisgender conspiracy. But I don't know what's she going to run for. Let's see. She's lost for governor twice, once by a point, once by 8 points. She's going to run for the Senate. I mean, look.
Well, if we look, Tim, at her disclosures, what we can find out is that Stacey Abrams is a massive financial beneficiary of her own her own campaigning. So when she ran the first time, I don't have the numbers here to present to you, but you know, she's increased her personal wealth by huge measures by running for office. Also, she gets to be friends with Oprah and be, I'm sure, you know, the Drew Barrymore show flies her out and staying at the lovely Beverly Wilshire on, you know, whatever.
At one point, she was even mentioned, not seriously, but mentioned on the short list of Joe Biden's vice presidential.
She put herself right at the top, Tim.
I think she was second on the list, you know, behind Kamala Harris. And I don't know that there was a third. But look, you know, actually, she was very successful as a fundraiser and organizer. And she really ought to stick with that because she is accomplished. She did amazing organizing to get the Democrats those two Senate seats in January of 21 that gave them control of the Senate.
Most accomplished at fundraising for Stacey Abrams, I think. And with that, we're going to go ahead and let you return to your studio.
Points unknown.
Parts unknown. Privileges. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Donner. See you next
week. Always a pleasure. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Entertaining, informative, and just plain fun. Watch Liberty Nation's The Conservative Five, produced by conservatives for conservatives. C5's The Left Free Zone, hosted by Liberty Nation's Lisa K. Donner, joined by a raucous, irreverent panel of authors, deconstructing leftist narratives, debating the hot topics, and remembering to laugh.
Heard it here first.
Join the official conservative safe space.
You only did that to piss Jeff off.
Liberty Nation's The Conservative Five.